Your eyes and your vision are under attack, damaging blue light from the sun, your phone, your computer, your tablet, even light bulbs and car headlights is constantly bombarding you. The good news is our eyes actually already have a line of defense to counter the effects of blue light. This defense is made up of three pigments called carotenoids. MacuHealth with MicroMicell, the only supplement with the exclusive patent on all three macular carotenoids and MicroMicell technology.
Do your patients know what presbyopia is?
There are people who are afraid of the press.
Have you talked to your patients about multifocal contact lenses?
I've heard the bifocal, but not
right,
multifocal.
Do you need help with your multifocal strategy? Learn more at the conclusion of this episode. With more screen usage and indoor time, myopia, also known as nearsightedness, is increasing and getting worse in children. Now, certified eye doctors can prescribe MySight One Day, the first and only FDA-approved soft contact lens to slow myopia progression in age-appropriate children. Visit CooperVision.com to find a Brilliant Futures certified eye doctor near you. Hello and welcome to the Open Your Eyes podcast. I'm Dr. Kerry Gelb, the host of the documentary Open Your Eyes. If you're new here and you like our interviews, press like, subscribe, share, and hit the bell to get notifications of great new interviews. Also, please leave comments. Great news, you can now watch our full-length documentary Open Your Eyes on Amazon Prime, Apple TV, iTunes, Google Play, and YouTube movies and shows. Also, please share your thoughts by emailing me at drkerrygelb@gmail.com. That's drkerryglb@gmail.com, and visit my website, drkerrygelb.com. Breathing, something we all do, but most of us give it little thought. Surprisingly, there is a proper way to breathe. Poor or improper breathing has been linked to anxiety, fatigue, poor sleep, faulty memory, panic attacks, and even headaches. Today's guest, Patrick McEwen. Because of unresolved health issues as a kid, Patrick has dedicated his life to the fascinating science of proper breathing. Patrick has provided breath training to improve health and sports performance for over 20 years. Patrick is creator, CEO, and director of education and training at Oxygen Advantage. He is a leading international expert on breathing and sleep, the author of 10 books, including the bestseller, The Oxygen Advantage and The Breathing Cure, which I have recently read, and it's a fantastic book. I recommend it to everybody out there watching. Patrick's work has been featured on many outlets, including the BBC, USA Today, TED Talks, the New York Times, The Times, UK, Men's and Women's Health Magazine. His mission is to empower people every day to breathe better, feel better, and achieve their potential. Patrick, thank you for joining me today on the Open Your Eyes podcast with Dr. Kerry Gelb.
It's a pleasure, Dr. Gelb. It's nearly embarrassing listening to that introduction. But anyway, we'll proceed.
You know, I'm so happy to have you. Reading your book, your personality comes out, your positive personality comes out in the book, and your love for helping people. And you really want to help people. And I could see from past interviews I've watched and listen to and reading the book. But I have to ask you, do people really breathe in correctly?
Not all. You know, it depends on the person. It's like everything else. There's a genetic predisposition, but there's also an environmental influence. But I think the major pressure that will influence breathing is stress, chronic stress. So it depends on the person.
Yeah, and you know, when we're born, We don't breathe through our mouth when we're born. We breathe through our nose. Is that correct?
Yeah, correct. Anatomically, it's very difficult for us to breathe through our mouths when we're born. And it's only maybe after a number of months that there's space that anatomically we can actually breathe through the mouth. And that's why it can be problematic for very young infants, because if they have a stuffy nose, they find it difficult to revert to mouth breathing because they're so reliant on nasal breathing. But children can be born with a compromised airway anatomically. And unfortunately, if the child is unable to breathe through the nose and can't switch to mouth breathing, it can suffer from lack of oxygen.
So let's get into it early. What is the proper way to breathe?
Well, first of all, it's in and out through the nose. That's the foundation. The mouth does absolutely zero for breathing. And breathing should be light. It should be slow. It should be driven by the diaphragm. Breathing should be effortless. And I think a lot of people who are listening that may have problematic breathing, they often feel that they can't take a satisfying breath. They feel that their breathing is an effort. Or they might notice their breathing is a little bit faster in upper chest. And if they're mouth breathing and they're waking up with a dry mouth in the morning, you know, so those are the typical traits that we would distinguish between a good breather and somebody with suboptimal breathing. But the easiest way to think of poor breathing patterns is ask yourself, how would one breathe when you get into a difficult situation? So when we get stressed as human beings, our breathing speeds up. So we're breathing more breaths per minute. We breathe harder, so we can take increased volume of air with each breath. We have irregular breathing patterns. We may stop breathing or we may be sighing frequently. We're breathing up our chest. There's no natural pause between breaths and we feel air hunger. And it's the same traits of how we breathe when we are feeling highly stressed as found in dysfunctional breathing. And there's an interesting cyclical loop there because, of course, it's not just going to be a stressful situation that changes your breathing patterns, but it's your underlying breathing pattern is going to influence your reaction to that stressful situation.
You know, I have a cousin who is a speech and language teacher. And when I started doing podcasts, he spent time with me breathing properly to speak. And it's almost the same way. And it took me a while to learn how to breathe through my nose and make my diaphragm expand when I'm speaking rather than doing mouth breathing and breathing where my diaphragm would go in and then my abdomen would go in. And it's something you could train, and I've gotten a lot better at it, but sometimes when I don't think about it, then I'll say, well, maybe I am mouth breathing and I have to go back to proper breathing. And when you're breathing properly, I do find that you actually can relax better and you actually sleep better when you're breathing properly. And if you could talk about some of the benefits of nasal breathing, and especially, you know, being a physician, an eye doctor, I'm very interested in how nasal breathing increases nitric oxide. And if you could talk about that and the benefits of nitric oxide to the body.
Yeah, the human nose performs a number of functions that the mouth simply doesn't do. You know, if you were to look into your mouth and ask, what is in your mouth? Okay, we have the teeth, we have the hard palate, soft palate, we have the throat, we have the tongue. None of those items do anything in terms of breathing. So the mouth has zero role to play other than to allow air straight down your throat into the lungs. And the nose does everything when it comes to the breath. I have a list of at least 30 functions of what the nose does. And one of those functions is, of course, harnessing the gas nitric oxide. So this gas nitric oxide was first discovered on the exhale breath of the human being only in 1991. So it's a relatively recent discovery, but it does a lot of work in terms of bronchodilation, redistribution of the blood throughout the lungs, sterilizing of the incoming air, dilating the blood vessels in the lungs. And it was discovered in 1988 that when individuals were continuously nasal breathing, the partial pressure of oxygen in the blood increased by nearly 10%. You also alluded to a few things. If you breathe through your mouth during sleep, and this is really what got me into, there were two things that got me into breathing. One was improving my breathing patterns made a tremendous difference to my airways, my asthma. And the second was people with asthma don't just have asthma. They very often have a stuffy nose and they're very often tired. Breathing through my nose significantly improved my sleep quality. So, you know, even for somebody to say, well, like we're not looking for nasal breathing 100% of the time. I know that when I'm talking here, in order to have a flow of sentence, there are times that I will take a light breath in from my mouth. That's normal. So, but we do want the mouth closed as much as we can bring it into our life, but we have to be realistic about it. Like, you know, the thing about mouth breathing is that there's no real definition of what constitutes a mouth breather. How long during the day or how much time during the day or during sleep do you have to have your mouth open before you become a mouth breather? Nobody really knows. So we have to use common sense. Breathing through the nose during sleep, you spend more time in deep sleep and less time in light sleep. It reduces the risk of snoring by 47% in a recent paper. Mild to moderate sleep apnea by 47%. So there are benefits in sleep, but also in states of mind with nose breathing. And the other thing I'll say, Dr. Galb, is when you breathe through your mouth, it typically activates the upper chest. And any of your listeners can think of that, because if they look down at their chest and if they take a breath through the mouth, they'll typically see that they are breathing higher. And that's not ideal, because the diaphragm is not just for respiration, but it provides stabilization for the spine. 50% of people with lower back pain have dysfunctional breathing. Up to 75% of people with anxiety and panic disorder have dysfunctional breathing. At least 30% of people with sleep apnea have dysfunctional breathing. The same figure for asthma, but unfortunately, breathing is quite understudied, so we don't always have specific numbers.
No, I thought it was also very interesting. And when you talked about the diaphragm, the diaphragm is right below the lungs. It's actually a muscle that's very important for us, the most important for us for breathing. But we talked about nitric oxide before, and I thought it was interesting because nitric oxide helps with the production of a pulmonary surfactant, which allows us to breathe easier and helps clear viruses. If you could just make a comment about that, because people are very worried about viruses right now, and breathing properly through the nose versus the mouth, you could lower your risk of viruses.
We've seen it over the years, you know, like a lot of people coming in with asthma, coming in with respiratory complaints, you know, they can be more prone to colds and chest infections. And we've seen when they switch to nose breathing, we've seen an improvement. And I remember when COVID first struck in February or in around February of 2020. In March of 2020, I did a video and I put it out to our own kind of followers. Everything went wrong. The lighting was wrong. The sound was wrong. My laptop, the battery was dying in it. One of those podcasts. But anyway, I talked about the importance. We knew there was a virus coming down the tracks and the importance of breathing in and out through the nose. And I gave the example that I had. I was on crowded tube station, tube in London, train, a subway, and a lot of people. And I did two things while I was standing on the tube. I was breathing in and out through my nose, but I was breathing lightly as well. In other words, I was minimizing the volume of air that I was taking into my lungs. I was doing everything that I could to reduce the airborne virus that was coming into the body. And on the understanding as well that when you breathe slow, you're having a higher concentration of nitric oxide coming from the nose into the lungs, and nitric oxide is helping to sterilize the incoming air. Now, I put that video out in March of 2020 with all of the exercises. It went on to about an hour on YouTube, and about a million people or so watched it. And I often found it so strange afterwards that while there was so much advice about wearing masks and washing your hands, there was no advice whatsoever about breathing in and out through your nose. The humble nose was completely forgotten about. And we shouldn't forget about this organ. It's not there for the fun of it. And, you know, I do understand that not everybody breathes in and out through the mouth. It's not that we mouth breathe 100% of the time. But if you're going for a walk, is your mouth open? If you're distracted, is your mouth open? If you're sleeping, do you wake up with a dry mouth in the morning? I know from observation that 50% of our own adults that we would have worked with over the last 20 years, 50% of them would wake up with a dry mouth in the morning. And if you wake up with a dry mouth in the morning, it's an indicator that you are breathing through your mouth during sleep.
And you talk about cadence. How many breaths should there be per minute? You know, people don't realize, I, when I was reading your book, it was like six, I think. And that sounds like a very little, but maybe I was misinterpreting.
Yeah, like this is an interesting one. What researchers found over the last 30 years was that when you slow down your breathing during a breathing practice, so in other words, not to breathe this way all the time, but if you slow down your breathing for, say, 10 minutes two times daily, down to six breaths per minute, that helps to stimulate the vagus nerve, but it also helps to strengthen what's called the baroreflex, the pressure receptors in the major blood vessels. And it helps, this in turn is helping to bring balance to the autonomic nervous system. So 6 breaths per minute is very interesting. You know, anything between 4.5 and 6.5 breaths per minute. Now, the only problem with focusing on cadence breathing is that I could have a client coming in with anxiety, and that client is breathing 19 or 20 breaths per minute and breathing using the upper chest. I can't go from 20 breaths per minute down to 6. Because if I slow down the breathing rate too much, they end up then taking 2 full breaths or 2 deep. The volume of air that they take in during each breath, it increases disproportionately, and they will feel too uncomfortable. So I suppose the thing about slowing down breathing is for the person to slow down their breathing relative to how they breathe. And I'll always say the example to anybody that I'm working with is, if you want to tell your brain that you are safe, because it's very, very important that we can communicate via our breath from the body to the brain. And if we want to tell the brain that we are safe, we need to focus on simply slowing down the speed of the exhalation by taking a soft breath in through the nose and a really relaxed and a slow and a gentle breath out. Because it's the speed of the exhalation, when we slow it down, the body is telling the brain that we are safe, and the brain will send signals then of calm to the body.
You know, a lot of doctors, integrative medicine doctors, talk about meditation and the way to breathe through meditation. You know, 4 seconds in, hold for 4 seconds. Some say 4 seconds out through the mouth. Some say 4 seconds out through the nose. Talk to me about meditation and breathing and how that's related. And is meditation really just breathing?
Well, one of the basic foundations of meditation is focusing on the breath. But I am going to say this. When we work with people with anxiety or panic disorder, it can be very challenging for them to meditate. And the reason being is because their underlying breathing pattern can be very much faster and harder. So their breathing pattern as being abnormal or suboptimal is feeding into their stress response. Now, we also know that when we breathe faster and harder in upper chest, if we are over breathing, which is one of the more common forms of breathing pattern disorders, we get rid of too much carbon dioxide, the gas, from the blood through the lungs. In other words, by breathing too much air, we get rid of too much carbon dioxide from the lungs. And this in turn reduces carbon dioxide in the blood leaving the lungs. This in turn affects the brain. So as carbon dioxide is lowered, blood pH increases and brain cells become more excitable. Now, there's nothing new about this, but there are new papers coming out that are written by a psychiatrist called Dr. Michael Binder. But I remember back in 2010 to 2013, Ireland wasn't in a good place economically. You know, a lot of people were losing jobs as they were in the United States and elsewhere. There was a lot of stress, a lot of angst. And I was given courses, small little short courses, and about 3,000 people attended those courses for anxiety, racing mind, stress, panic disorder. These people can't meditate. Like when your mind is racing, it's very, very difficult to bring an awareness to your breathing or to be observant of what's going on in the mind. And it really depends on what's people's definition of meditation. You know, what does the word awareness mean? But my interpretation of awareness would be that you're stepping back and you're observing what's going on in the mind. But when your mind is racing and you're in an emotional turmoil, it's probably the last thing that you want to be doing. And even when you're in that stage, even focusing on your breathing can be challenging. So we give small little breath holds, but some people with anxiety, I say to them, listen, the best breathing exercise you could do is go for a walk with your mouth closed. It is a tremendous breathing exercise. And it's a physical exercise. And as you're walking with your mouth closed, bring your attention and disperse it throughout your body, or just bring your senses into present moment awareness. See and listen and feel. In other words, have little tools that you can do to get your attention out of your head, because too often we're stuck in our head and we're stuck in this rumination of thought. And of course, the body doesn't know the difference between a real event and an imagined event. So if there was a real event taking place, of course, our body will react to that. But also, if we are having our imagination run wild and we're having this catastrophe going on in the mind, our body is going to react the same to the same stress response. So coming back to your question, mindfulness and meditation is tremendous. But I think it's very important for people with a racing mind to look at their underlying breathing pattern first, because you could be doing all of the mindfulness in the world, but if you're going around with your mouth open and fast breathing and hard breathing, it's your dysfunctional breathing which is feeding into a stress response. And the other thing that I will say is that people with anxiety and stress and panic, they also often have poor sleep quality. And if you have poor sleep, you are going to have an agitated mind. You cannot have a calm mind with stillness of the mind if you have underlying sleep issues. So we need to look at the bi-directional relationship between breathing, our sleep, and our state of mind.
Now, I don't know if anyone's asked you to do this before, but is it possible for you to demonstrate, you know, we have the camera, the proper way to breathe? Would you mind?
You're not going to see much, you know. In terms of, like, if I bring my camera down here, and if I have my hand, one on my chest, so you want to have minimal movement from the chest. So this would be breathing high. You want to have about 80% of your movement is driven by the diaphragm. As the diaphragm is moving downwards, it creates a negative pressure in the thorax and air comes into the lungs. It's not the air coming into the lungs that drives the diaphragm downwards, but it's the movement of the diaphragm downwards that enlarges the volume of the chest, which brings air into the lungs. As the diaphragm moves downwards, you will have some movement to the front, some movement to the sides, and some movement to the back. If I have my hands on my sides here, just so my diaphragm breathing muscle is here, you're not going to feel it. It's just at the base of your ribs. My hands are on my sides. As I breathe in, I would like to have minimal movement of my chest, and I would like to feel my lower ribs moving out.
I can feel it with myself right now, and I'm doing it properly.
But and it's as simple as that. You know, like, the thing about somebody...
Thank you for that, by the way.
MacuHealth, your science-born and tested solutions for visual performance, macular degeneration, and dry eye syndrome. New products coming soon. Embrace the science.
No, you're fine, because sometimes it's difficult enough to demonstrate because there doesn't be a whole lot to see. And I think for people, if you have a cat in your house, a cat is probably a better example than a dog. The cat is an innate nasal breather, even during running. The cat will have a regular breathing pattern, will be silently breathing. Of course, now we've messed up with the cat's anatomy too, so maybe your cat snores, but we say if a cat was in the wild, it's not going to snore. And it would be driven by the diaphragm. So good breathing is in and out through the nose. It's effortless. It's light. It's slow. It's low. And there's a natural pause after the exhalation.
I think it was interesting that if you have a big nose, it's easier to breathe than if you have a small nose.
It is, because, yeah, and you know, this can be race influenced as well, because whatever way throughout our evolution, you know, our body adapts to the environment that we're living in, like our ancestors and Neanderthals. There was a study that came out about 2 years ago, and the scientists who did the research, they concluded that Neanderthals breathed exclusively through their nose, both during rest, but also during physical exercise. And they made that conclusion because their nasal airway was so well developed to handle a large volume of air. Now, Caucasians, we are not great, to be honest with you. Like, I have one nostril that's pinched and the other nostril, I have a deviated septum. So if when I do physical exercise, I wear a nasal dilator. So it's about having functional breathing, but you also want to have a good anatomy. And unfortunately, my anatomy is not good. And that would have been from years of mouth breathing. And that's another question. You know, a child that's growing up with the mouth open, does it influence the development of the face? And the question is, or the answer is yes. And once that happens, then this is what you're left with for the rest of your life.
Well, me and my family should be good nose breathers, because we all have big noses in my family.
Well, so that's what you want. You will be able to sprint with your mouth closed. You can't get any better than that.
I want to ask you about the Russian scientist, Dr. Buteyko.
And yes.
What you learned from him and what he discovered, because, you know, his name is attached to breathing. And I know there's a certain belt the Buteyko belt that I want to talk about later when we talk about different devices, you know, taping and things. So we'll save that for later. But tell me about Dr. Buteyko and what you learned from him and why his name is attached to a lot of breathing.
Yeah, he made a discovery. So he was a Ukrainian doctor that was working in the Soviet Union. And part of his work at the time was during the Soviet space race with, of course, USA, the United States. And he made a discovery which, when he was working then with his patients, he observed that sick patients breathed too fast and too hard. And he asked the question, he said, is it their sickness that's causing a change to their breathing patterns? Or could their faulty breathing be feeding back into their sickness? And that was just a simple observation. So he taught his students or his patients to soften and slow down their breathing to the point of a tolerable air hunger. It's a really interesting breathing exercise. And I would say it's my favorite breathing exercise. We use about 26 different techniques. That one we call Breathe Light. And when I started practicing it, I remember sitting down and I had one hand on my chest and one hand just above my navel. And I really softened and slowed down the speed of the air coming into my nose, almost that my breath in was imperceptible. And then I had a really, really relaxed and slow, gentle breath out. The objective was to soften and slow down my breathing so that I was breathing about 20% less air into the body. This in turn generated a feeling of air hunger, which signifies that carbon dioxide is accumulated a little in the lungs and blood. And as carbon dioxide accumulates in the blood, I could feel the temperature of my hands and feet increasing. In other words, I was able to directly influence my blood circulation, not by breathing more air, but actually by breathing less air. Now, I was in my 20s at the time. I had a stuffy nose, which I unblocked my nose using his technique as well. So if you have a stuffy nose, take a normal breath in and out through the nose, pinch the nose, and just gently nod your head up and down, even if it's for just 10 times or 15 times. Then let go, but breathe in through your nose. Wait about 30 seconds and do it again. I did the nose and blocking exercise and it alleviated my nasal congestion. I knew it worked. And then I practiced doing the light and slow breathing and I could feel the temperature of my hands increasing. I always had cold hands and feet. Now, the thing that I found amazing about this exercise at the time, Dr. Galb, was because this flew in the face of what was traditionally taught in breathing. And I remember going into university, and I went to a university in Dublin. I had an exam, a pretty serious exam at the time, 1996. And I was a bit stressed going in. I was already a mouth breather, upper chest breather, a faster breather. And when you breathe that way, you don't have a great resilience towards difficult situations or challenging situations. So I was feeling stressed. I took a walk before going into the exam. And during that walk, for about 1 or 2 minutes, I took these full big breaths because that's all I was hearing at the time. If you're stressed, take a deep breath. I read a book at the time, which encouraged to take these full big breaths. So that's what I did. And I walked into the exam and I knew I was all over the place. I was lightheaded. I wasn't able to concentrate to the same degree. I didn't realize that the full deep breaths that I was after practicing...
Just interrupt for a second. I'm sorry. It's 4 deep breaths that you took was through your mouth, not through your nose.
I honestly can't say which way I took them. But all I remembered was taking these full big breaths. So what I was doing was I was breathing more air into my body than what I needed. And the problem with breathing too much air relative to what my body needed, I was blowing off too much carbon dioxide. And that in turn reduced carbon dioxide in the blood and increased blood pH, which resulted in a significant reduction of blood flow and oxygen delivery to my brain. The very time that I wanted to have absolute cognition, I didn't have it because I was after sabotaging it due to a breathing technique which reduced blood flow and oxygen delivery to my brain. Now, 25 years on, the same belief is out there about breathing. Dr. Buteyko, he turned this on its head back in the 1960s. I think it was 1957. And he talked about healthy people, you don't see their breathing. You don't hear their breathing. They're breathing in and out through the nose. And compare that to an unhealthy person. If you were to see them walking down a sidewalk and they're getting out of breath, they're doing minimal physical exercise, but they're breathing a lot in comparison to what their metabolic needs are. And we will see this, you know, even if you see it with work colleagues and you start to see your work colleague getting a little bit stressed. And then next thing is you're hearing them sigh more, they're breathing harder and they're breathing faster. Like, we have to get it out of the public domain about the misinformation about the importance and benefits of big breathing. Big breathing is a problem. It is a problem. And we have to be thinking about normalizing breathing. We want to undo the bad habits that we have developed over the years. And we are living a lot differently now than we were throughout our evolution. You know, we're sedentary more. We're eating different foods. We all know what we are doing incorrectly. I know we still do it and society drives that. But even just the information, if people understood that the more air you breathe, the less oxygen that's delivered throughout the body. And if your objective is to decongest your nose and help open up your airways, well, number one, the more you breathe through the nose, the better it works. If your nose is stuffy, do a breath hold. If you want to induce relaxation, simply take a soft breath in through your nose and a really slow, relaxed and gentle breath out. Because when you have that slow and relaxed and gentle breath out, you stimulate the vagus nerve. And this in turn is secreting a neurotransmitter called acetylcholine, which is causing the heart rate to slow down. And when the heart rate slows down, the brain interprets that the body is safe. And the regular practice of breathing exercises, you're taking your attention out of your body, out of your mind, sorry, and into your body and onto the breath. And you're helping to bring a quietness and a stillness to the mind. But it's not just that it's directed attention. By slowing down your breathing, you're helping to bring balance to the autonomic nervous system. By breathing a little bit less air, you're helping to increase blood flow and oxygen delivery to the brain. And it was an amazing paper written back in 1988. And it talked about the brain, by regulating breathing, regulates its own excitability. Now, I had written about that paper in a book I wrote in 2010. And then I'd kind of forgotten about the book. Well, it's still there. It's still for sale. But I was listening to a podcast by Dr. Andrew Huberman. And he referenced the same paper. And I was thinking to myself, I know that paper. And he referenced the exact same sentence that I had put into the book. The brain, by regulating breathing, controls its own excitability. So what's the relevance of that? Well, the human brain needs 20% of our oxygen. It's only 2% of our body weight, but it needs 20% of our oxygen, 20% oxygen consumption. We can directly influence oxygen consumption via our breathing. And it's not about breathing more air. So, you know, that last exercise, remember I was saying that if somebody was anxious, sometimes the best exercise that they could do was actually go for a walk with their mouth closed and walk at a pace that they can sustain nasal breathing. The reason being is because they'll find it easier to do. You know, they're doing physical exercise, they're going to be distracted, but as they're doing physical exercise, they're producing more carbon dioxide. Now, if they are breathing through their nose while doing their physical exercise, carbon dioxide will accumulate in their blood. And we would expect from our own trials as well over the years, that carbon dioxide will increase by about 2 to 3 millimeters of mercury. This will increase blood flow to the brain by between 6 and 12%. And this will have a calming effect on the brain. So there's a big difference when somebody does their physical exercise with their mouth open versus when they do their physical exercise with their mouth closed.
And I think there's an interesting point, because people think that CO2 or carbon dioxide is bad, but it's not bad. It has to be a good balance. But when we hyper breathe or hyperventilation, we can raise the pH and that could become dangerous. And if you could speak about that.
Yeah, and it's not as if people are having an acute hyperventilation attack. You know, sometimes we feel when we hear the word hyperventilation that the person is having a panic attack here in the corner. No, that's not it. All it means is that our breathing is a little bit too fast and or too hard, so that the volume of air that we are breathing is too much. That's all. And it's every minute, every hour, every day. And when we breathe too much air, we get rid of too much carbon dioxide from the lungs. So as carbon dioxide is lowered in the lungs, it in turn is lowered in the blood leaving the lungs. And with the loss of carbon dioxide in the blood, blood pH increases. And this causes arousal of the central nervous system. In scientific terms, with the loss of carbon dioxide, we have what's called a left shift of the oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve. But what this means is that hemoglobin, which is the main carrier of oxygen, these are the proteins in the red blood cells. They hold on to oxygen too strongly. So it's kind of ironic. The more air we breathe relative to what we need, by blowing off too much carbon dioxide, by reducing it in the blood, hemoglobin holds on to oxygen too strongly and doesn't release it. So what else would happen? Yeah, you're so correct when you say that blood pH should be normal. It should be 7.365. If it goes too alkaline to 7.8, we die. If it's too acidic to 6.8, we die. So homeostasis is at 7.365, 7.4. The first documented cases of hyperventilation, it was called the Costa syndrome. And it was soldiers returning from the American Civil War. So you can imagine these individuals, they were at the front line for a period of time and they were exposed to high stress levels. And this in turn, this stress is going to change your breathing patterns. And even when the stress is removed, so when these soldiers returned home into civilian life from the front line, they still had the symptoms associated with hyperventilation, increased breathlessness, poor sleep. That can, you can have chest pain or bronchoconstriction as a result of it as well, brain fog, chronic fatigue, increased lactic acid with doing physical exercise. So it's very interesting, the whole aspect of hyperventilation syndrome. Now, I know there are, it's not black and white, and it doesn't always take a drop of carbon dioxide to produce the symptoms of hyperventilation. However, if a person is breathing a little bit too fast and too hard for what they need, it's going to have some impact on that person, depending on their genetic predisposition. And the first thing that I would say is it's likely to make them more stressed, because you talked about nose inducing relaxation, and it does, because when you breathe through your nose, you've got a better recruitment of the diaphragm, but you have slower breathing. Mouth breathing is faster breathing in its upper chest. And we have to be very careful what the body is telling the brain. And if you were to go into Google and put in slow breathing Stanford Medical School, scientists at Stanford discovered a new structure. Well, it's not a new structure, but they discovered a structure in the brain. And they said that this structure is spying on your breathing. And if you breathe fast during rest, your brain is interpreting that your body is under threat, and your brain will send arousal. That part of the brain will send arousal to other parts of the brain. We also know that stress contributes to inflammation, but we also know that by light and slow breathing, by stimulating the vagus nerve, that it can help to block pro-inflammatory cytokines, the chemical messengers that trigger inflammation. Like, there's an amazing connection between the breath when it's properly practiced. I understand we need a lot more research. And I think part of what has held things back was that breathing was seen as this left of field. It was seen as this woo-woo category. But it's really time that we start bringing it into mainstream. It's logical. It is scientifically based, provided that the instructor who is teaching it understands what they are teaching.
Well, it's woo-woo because there's no drug I can give you to make you breathe better.
Yes.
So something we do every day. I just want to summarize a little bit and correct me if any of my summary is wrong, but the power of correct breathing, it makes us calmer. It decreases stress. It makes us stronger. You live longer. We increase energy, better concentration. We can deal with stress better. We can improve blood circulation by about 10 to 20%. We improve sleep. We could quiet the mind. We could delay lactic acid and fatigue and strengthen the breathing muscles that we use. So those are some of the things that I've taken out of having proper, correct breathing. Did I leave anything important out? And would you like to comment on any of that list?
I agree with all of the points that you said there. And the risk is that People then think it's a cure-all. And it wasn't myself, actually, that came up with the title of the book. That was our USA publisher. And I said, I'd copy it.
Sure.
So, yeah, because I would always shy away from that, because I suppose when I'm working with people, I only focused on three main areas. I focused on respiratory health. We could see the difference. We were helping with people with asthma. It makes common sense. Breathe in and out through your nose. Breathe light, breathe slow, breathe low. We know we can improve gas exchange, etc. That's 30% of the adult population we work with. I also work a lot with people with racing mind, with high stress, with panic disorder and anxiety. We know there is a role for breathing there. And it's not just about directing your attention, but it's actually about helping to bring balance to the autonomic nervous system. And about 30% of the people I work with, they attend with insomnia, snoring, or obstructive sleep apnea. The field of obstructive sleep apnea is really, really interesting, because it affects, according to a Lancet study in 2017, 936 million people on the planet. Almost 1 billion people have obstructive sleep apnea. It affects between 25 and 50% of men and about 10 to 30% of women, but it gets worse as we age because we lose muscle tone and the upper airway. The muscles in the upper airway don't do their job as effectively, and they don't maintain an open airway during sleep. And when the airway collapses, we stop breathing. And when we stop breathing, we're aroused from sleep. Our blood oxygen saturation drops, carbon dioxide increases, and it disrupts our sleep. It causes sleep fragmentation, but it puts a lot of pressure on the body, on the heart, you could argue on the brain, etc. So I would look at those main three fields: respiratory, mental health, and sleep disorder breathing. And I think there's a really nice tie-in there. In the book itself, I looked at epilepsy, because that has been written about for almost 100 years. And doctors, for example, in hospitals with children, they sometimes get children to hyperventilate to see what happens in the brain as a result. See, when one hyperventilates, it increases neuronal excitability. So we have 80 billion brain cells, and each brain cell is communicating with 15,000 other brain cells. We don't want our brain cells firing all over the place. If the brain cells are firing all over the place, not only for normal individuals, it could cause agitation of the mind, but for some people with epilepsy, it could trigger a seizure. What else did I look at? I looked at posture as well, lower back pain, the role that the diaphragm has in maintaining stabilization of the spine. And when people think about the core, they think that the core is purely the abs, the abdominal muscles. For an actual fact, the core should be thought of as a box. You've got the pelvic floor at the bottom. You've got the diaphragm to the top. You've got the abs to the front and the spinal muscles to the back. So there's nice connections. Diabetes type 1, type 2, there's a connection there. I suppose the underlying thing is this, Dr. Galb. People who are chronically unwell, either physically or emotionally, they are in an increased stress response. And it's the increased stress response can be feeding back into their sickness. So what we want to do is we want to help dampen the stress response and increase relaxation.
Your eyes and your vision are under attack. Damaging blue light from the sun, your phone, your computer, your tablet, even light bulbs and car headlights is constantly bombarding you. The good news is our eyes actually already have a line of defense to counter the effects of blue light. This defense is made up of three pigments called carotenoids. MacuHealth with MicroMicell, the only supplement with the exclusive patent on all three macular carotenoids and MicroMicell technology.
Fitting multifocal contact lenses presents a big opportunity to meet patient needs while growing your practice. Alcon is your partner not only with our innovative portfolio, but through e-learning. Learn to enhance your multifocal strategy today with the Alcon Experience Academy.
OIE Broadcasting is the emerging leader in social media. We use scientific entertainment to drive more patients into your office. Visit OIEBroadcasting.com and sign up today.